Down where you want to sit.
All right. Well, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Am I on your way here or am I on your way here?
Mom just informed me that it's not April, and she's correct. Last time we had, on our last installment of the series, you were either hopefully gained some new insights on the Sabbath or at least rekindled some of your appreciation for it, for truly it is a gift from Yehovah as he shares his holiness with us. Pretty amazing. I'm sure it was also an amazing time that Moshe has had with Yehovah up on that mountain. We've been covering that. We concluded last time with God finishing giving Moshe those initial instructions, at least for now, to him. And Yehovah then giving him the tablets with the 10 words. So, of course, that is the basis for the covenant. It's the basis for all the ordinances and the statutes and the laws and everything that will come as we move forward here. All of that is based on those 10 words. So, the next words of Yehovah that we find are in the very next chapter, in chapter 32, and it involves the kind of infamous golden calf incident. Okay? So as we go over here to chapter 32, Moshe's still on the mountain, but let's read what Yehovah has to say here, beginning in verse 7. He said, "And Yehovah said to Moshe, 'Go get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." And Yehovah said to Moshe, "I've seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, and I'll make you a great nation." Those are some pretty strong words indeed. God was simply going to just wipe them out and start over clean with Moshe. Now, the key to understanding the scriptures about the golden calf is that Israel was breaking the covenant God had just made with them at the very same, simultaneously, at the very same moment that Moshe was up on the mountain receiving it. Remember, this was a conditional covenant. Israel had obligations to keep in it. And because the covenant has stipulations about what happens if they don't, that's very clear. They had obligations. So God sees what Israel did by building this calf as adultery. It was adultery. And so therefore, of course, infidelity. But why adultery? Because they were supposed to be in union with him. And so then when they brought another god, small g, into the picture, even if it was supposed to represent him, it was symbolic of breaking that covenant, that marriage covenant. You don't bring another party or another thing into the marriage, right? So what's interesting to me too is really it's stories like these and other stories in the Next Testament where it really makes the Bible stand out from any other piece of literature, and it's even an insult to call it literature because it stands so high above it, but it's things like this that show that the Bible's inspired. Because look, if you were trying to put a collection of stories together for the Jewish people, you know, to make them look good, to tell their story, right? Would you put this in there? These are a people that are supposed to be set apart from the world, that are a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Would you include this story? It sure doesn't make them look very good, does it? So rather than try to paint Israel now as somehow better than other humans or less susceptible to doing wrong and evil about, you know, temptations around immorality, you know, that maybe these are just a bunch of people that are just good and they just go about whistling as they work and doing good things for God. But that's not true. Because on display in this story is our fickleness, our selfishness, our rebellious nature, vividly on display here in this chapter. And it's a stark contrast to God's character and how He really desired them to be, and they weren't matching that. They weren't living up to that. And so, see, since chapter 24 of Exodus, it's like we've been eavesdropping, sort of, on this conversation between Moshe and Yehovah, and what are they talking about? You know, they're on high in Mount Sinai. This was, as I discussed before, it's a symbolic picture of the Holy of Holies, and they're there, and Moshe is learning all of these things about the heavenly realm, about everything that's good and pure and perfect and wonderful, this spiritual high ideal. And it's being given to and spoken to Moshe, even plans to replicate that in the physical as a reminder, a shadow of his dwelling place. And while that's happening, that very thing that's happening, you use the phrase, well, meanwhile, back at the ranch, right? What's happening? We're seeing the reality of a corrupted physical life that contrasts and conflicts with God's standards, just marching on. And we shouldn't sidestep the irony here. Again, during the very time that Moshe is receiving these incredible revelations from Yehovah, standing on, being in the Holy of Holies, during that time where God has actually lowered himself down to that point and is giving this out as a beckoning call to redeem his people and bring them back to himself. This is what they're doing at the same exact time. And scheming to do the very things that Yehovah just thundered down from that mountain. Everybody there had heard him say, "Have no other gods before me." They all heard it. But what did they hear? Well, we basically know what we hear. We get the answer to that by their actions, right? Basically, they heard, yeah, we know there's a God. We know he's loving and powerful because of what he just did for us. We know he has standards of good and evil, right and wrong, but we're kind of anxious about this. We're kind of stressed because, you know, Moshe didn't come right back down. So, you know, we need to take things into our own hands. We need to do this our way. Thanks, but no thanks. We got this, right? How very human that is. Because it hasn't gotten any better, has it? Still today, in rampant fashion, we see God's clear instructions for when and how he prescribes to be worshipped, cast aside for the when and how that countless churches and countless people have decided on their own, as if they know better than Yehovah himself how he wants to be worshipped. So I'm just going to put it bluntly, okay? Here it is. Sunday worship, it's a golden calf. Christmas celebrations, a golden calf. Sunrise services at Easter, a golden calf. Taking the bread and wine whenever they darn well please, whenever the board meets and decides that it's the right time to do it, is a golden calf. The list could go on and on and on, couldn't it? As sovereign, God alone has the right and to give us the direction of how he is to be worshipped, period. The first few verses of chapter 32 then set about, you know, explaining to us how they justified, or, you know, what the people's rationale was on how or why they should break these commandments. Specifically talking about, you know, the ones like, have no other gods before me, or don't make a graven image, you know. Notice the justification here. Verse 1. Now, when the people saw that Moshe delayed coming down from the mountain. Oh, well, Christ isn't coming, so we just do whatever we want. You got to get the parallels here. When people saw that Moshe delayed coming down the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron, to other religious leaders, and said to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. Let's do this our way. For as for this Moshe, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. He isn't coming back. He isn't here. So basically the rationale was, well, you know, we're impatient. We need to do things the way we've always done them. We need to go back to doing them the way we did them in Egypt. But God was plain when he thundered down from them that that's not how it should be. No multiple gods. Don't try to make an image of me. It's insulting to use things that are created to try to represent the Creator. He's above all of it. And this multiple God thing is patently wrong. He's one. There is one God, he said. And you are symbolically marrying him in a covenant. You don't bring a false carved thing, even if it's going to represent him, into the marriage. So it should, anyone that reads this, it should hit you square between the eyes that adultery was at the heart of the Israelites' great offense here. Adultery. Because what the Mosaic covenant created was a union between Israel and Yehovah, and mixing that union with Yehovah, with a calf or anything else, by bringing something else in the picture, the union became corrupted. And that's what he said. They have corrupted themselves. Now, some make the argument that it wasn't another God, that it was to represent Yehovah. So he didn't bring another God, and this represented Yehovah. Well, the trouble with that is that God just told him not to do that. Not to make a graven image or a carved image. And make no mistake, that golden calf wasn't alive. It was dead. It was a graven, dead image. And I just present to you, it's the same rationale that you hear from people today. Well, look, I'm not worshiping pagan gods on Sunday. How many times have I heard that? I'm not worshiping Estvar on Easter. I'm not worshiping Santa Claus on Christmas. I'm worshiping Jesus. I'm worshiping the God of the Bible. How can you say that after reading this story? They tried that rationale. Exactly. It's an exact, complete parallel. They tried it. I mean, they heard the voice of God. They knew firsthand it was God. They knew it was God. They knew better than most, a lot of people. How many of us have actually heard God thunder instructions and vibrate the ground to us? But yet, they turned right around and did exactly what he said for them not to do. Then they tried to set something up to worship him their way. What did God say? Here it is. We already read it. Basically, that they are a stiff-necked, stubborn nation wanting to do things their way. That's just stubbornness. I don't want to get rid of my traditions. My mama taught me Christmas. You know what I'm saying? How is this any different than what we see today? This event shows us clearly that God does not want us substituting things, even if we are using them to worship Him and not a false God. That is a blatant primary lesson here. But a lot of people will come and then they'll say, okay, Jesus came and changed all that. We've redeemed these things for Him. And I got to thinking about that in this context, and I'm going to ask you a question. Whom did the Israelites recruit to lead them to do this? Of all the possible people, who led them to do this? None other than the one that was to later become the high priest. Look at this. Verse 2. And Aaron said to them, Aaron, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a golden calf. And then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. So they're trying to apply this to the true God. And so when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. Aaron! And Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast of the Lord. And they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Can you see the link and the irony here? Here we have Aaron, who would later become the high priest. Now, he isn't yet. And he's the one that makes this thing and makes this proclamation. Here is your God. The one that just brought you. He's referring to the one that just brought you out of Israel or out of Egypt, just spoke to you on the mountain. Here he is. He's redeeming this thing for use, for worship. But can he do that? No. At this point, Aaron is not the high priest. He's not symbolically representing Yeshua as he will later on in different ceremonies like the Day of Atonement. I submit to you at this moment, prior to him being ordained, he's being a false Christ. He's being a false Christ. And he's picturing what many false Christs do still today to teach men to do this exact same thing. You hear me? The exact same thing. Redeeming golden calves in the name of worshiping the true God. And doing it with the supposed position of authority to do so. Think about it. Aaron was Moshe's second in command. He's the one that carried the staff. He spoke the miracles of God before Pharaoh. This was Moshe's own brother. He was speaking from the proverbial pulpit when he did this. And he's the one that later on, as I said, on the Day of Atonement, that will actually stand in place of, symbolically, Yeshua himself. Yet at this point, he's acting as a false Christ. The one that would picture him later is picturing him here first, prior to him actually representing God as representing a false God, a false Christ. Just as false Christ today have built golden calves, like I said, like Sunday worship, and tried to pass them off as God's true Sabbath. All in the name, supposedly, of Christ. Representing authority, just like Aaron was doing here, exercising authority that hadn't been given them. And I think it's really interesting. And I don't know how to, I don't think it really needs much. He instructed the people to to give them gold from their earrings. And I thought, how poignant is that? In hearing, they didn't hear him. God thundered down. Did they hear him? No, they didn't hear him. I don't know, maybe it was the earrings that blocked the message. Maybe it was the earrings were big. I don't know. But it's kind of wild that obviously they didn't really hear what God had said, and it was earrings that they made the golden calf out of. It's just is it just an ironic coincidence? I don't think so. Usually nothing in God's word is a coincidence. And if you think about how many earrings do you need to make that big old golden calf? I mean, there was a lot of people that bought into this and was like, oh yeah, this is a great idea. Let's do that. Here's my earrings. Okay? So what's that mean? It means that the masses, remember how big we talked about Israel was at the base of that mountain? The masses were in agreement with this. Just like the masses today have ear problems. Even those that hear, supposedly, the message of Christ don't really hear it to obedience. Look what Yeshua said, Matthew 13, verse 13. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. And in them the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled, which says, hearing you will hear and shall not understand, and seeing you will see and not perceive. For the hearts of this people have grown dull, a stiff-necked maybe. Their ears are hard of hearing, their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, lest they should understand with their heart and turn, meaning obey, turn towards what God says, so that I should heal them. This is a huge lesson, guys, of the golden calf incident. To really hear God means that we take what he said and we apply it. Had they done that, had they really heard him, the instant someone would have had this idea, hey, let's make a golden calf. They're like, nah, God just said not to. You see how easy that is? When you just hear and you obey, Shema. They would have said, no, we can't do that. But they didn't do that because in hearing, they didn't really hear and believe to the point of obedience. And that's the disconnect. Because once the calf was made, just what did the Hebrews think they had made? What they think they'd done? What was it that they thought they had made to represent? It's in the proclamation that Aaron made. This is your God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. So it was clear. And they announced it tomorrow. He announced tomorrow, well, we're going to build an altar and we're going to have sacrifices and a feast. To who? He said, we're going to have a feast to Yehovah. Now, if you read that in your Bible, it's probably going to say a festival to the Lord. But that's an incorrect translation. And it's led many people to think that they didn't think that they were using that to worship Yehovah, but small L Lord, right? Another God, right? Which is bad in itself, but then it helps them with this, undo this argument that we're making today. It's not really an argument, it's just it's a plain and parallel analogy to what was going on, right? So it allows them then to not have to take stock of any golden calves that they've built, right? So understand that in that scripture where a lot of times it says festival to the Lord, it's incorrect. It doesn't say Lord as an Adonai or whatever. It is YHWH, which is Yehovah, the personal name of God. So he said, this is your God. Right, we're going to have a festival to who? A festival to Yehovah, not to another God. So, what's the takeaway here, guys? What's the point? We should take stock for whatever golden calves that we have built thinking that we're worshiping the true God with them. By God's grace, He has helped us remove some of the obvious ones. You know, we don't do Sunday worship. We don't, you know, worship the sunrise at Easter and these type of things. But there's more that are way more subtle than that. And I want to propose that that would be the topic of our discussion afterward. What are the golden calves that are still left in our lives that we need to grind up and throw into the water of the Word? That's what Moshe did. He took the golden calf and he ground it up and he threw it in the water. So there are a lot of lessons just under the surface here, and we could spend a lot of time, but I want to talk about just a few of them. First, the golden calf was a common image used in worship of pagan idols in Middle Eastern culture. In Egypt, it was called the Apsis Bull, and it was a pretty high deity. It represented strength, it represented authority, and the Hebrews would have had a lot of familiarity with it. Now, we can't be for sure that that's, you know, the image that they used, but it really doesn't matter. The point is that despite all these incredible miracles that they had personally witnessed and hearing the voice of Yehovah himself issue the 10 words, at the very first sign of trouble, what was their instinct? To go right back, to not trust God, to not be obedient to God, but to take matters in their own hands and go right back to what they had always done. And the funny thing about that is, had it ever worked for them before? I mean, they were in captivity and had been for 2 centuries. How many sacrifices did they make to those pagan gods? How many prayers did they make to those pagan gods? How many times did they rub their bellies or whatever, do whatever they did, right? Did it work? No. And so the only one that ever did, they turned their back on immediately. It's really crazy. But you know, people haven't changed a whole lot. Because when push comes to shove, we love the things that are familiar. We love the status quo. It's comfortable. We don't like to change. It satisfies our emotions and our wants. I've heard it said, you all have too, many times, that the definition of insanity is to continue to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. Well, that's what they were doing. You know, they had worshipped all these pagan idols, and then, you know, now they just go right back to it, expecting a different result this time now. So I just submit that there probably isn't anybody here or at the sound of my voice that doesn't struggle on a daily basis with not wanting to hang on to or return to our old ways, even though we know that there are things that we need to change. So secondly, why did the people feel that they needed a God image at all? It's kind of a question. I mean, what's the big attraction to a thing to represent God? I mean, it seems like it's a human need for a visual, tangible evidence of God. And it drove them to do this. It's a human need. The need to see things for ourselves, to analyze things for ourselves. You know, we used to have a saying in Missouri, you know, that, you know, now I've lost it.
Show me
state. Show me. I want to see it myself. I want to prove it for myself. So but God knew that, right? That they wanted to see it with their own eyes. So while they're doing that at the base of the mountain, what is God giving Moshe? A picture of the heavenly realm that they can see with their own eyes. listen, our God knows us, and He knows us, and He knows us better than we know ourselves. And He was giving them, if they just be a little patient, He was giving them exactly what they really needed. But it was going to come in His time, in His way, in His ordination, and doing it with heavenly principles that even enshrined, as we talked about, the sacred spaces that we discussed. He was giving them right what they wanted. So there is this parallel link between the golden calf and the tabernacle, as they were both intended to satisfy man's need to have a visual proof of God's existence. It might do us well to think of the golden calf as sort of an anti-tabernacle, like an anti-Christ. The golden calf is man's perverse idea of deity. And you contrast that with the tabernacle, which was a heavenly model. It was God ordained. But it also comes with God's timing, not theirs. A parallel example of this is Sunday worship based on something they could see, right? Physically, versus the Sabbath, which God ordained in His timing. Man ordained, God ordained. This is the battle that humanity has been in practically since the moment creation ceased. And it will go on until the end of the millennial rule. Probably some of us in our lifetimes will see this battle played out in dramatic fashion, I might add. The finality of the history of the world as we know it, ruled by Satan. And we're going to watch mankind follow this exact pattern. I want you to think about that. Because the world will do it for the same reasons that the Israelites molded their image. Impatience and fear and anxiety. It's building, isn't it? All over the world. What's going to happen? Who's going to save us? What's this going to look like? We need some visual proof of God, of a leader. It's the world is crying out to build that new golden calf, to do something to stop the violence and the terror and everything that's gripped this world. And soon, very soon, I believe that the apostate portion of the church will actually join in that same effort. People that have heard God but did not hear God, and they will be led with an errand to identify and install this end time golden calf. So now I want you to circle back to our earlier point. Because just as in Moshe's day, this will occur. Think about this now. It's going to occur at the very same time that God is in process of readying the world for a visible display of God's true presence in the form of Messiah Yeshua. What do I mean by that? At the very same time that down at the bottom of the mountain where we're at now with the world, and the world gearing up towards needing this golden calf, what's happening in the spirit realm? God is opening the minds of His people even more than ever before. He's preparing His bride. And so you got to ask yourself, do you want to be on the floor of the valley at the base of that mountain and worshiping that golden calf, however it's built? Or have you set your mind and your heart and your ears and your eyes to what's happening at the summit and being the bride? Because those things are happening right now. I just perceive that. They're happening right now, simultaneously. And you cannot be on the floor of the valley floor and on high at the same time. It's critical. We are seeing a direct parallel to this story playing out before our very eyes. Sadly, we know from the Bible, primarily Revelation, that most of the world, and all but just a remnant, it says, a small remnant of the church, will not wait for God's solution. They won't wait down there patiently. We'll take matters in our own hands, and it will be devastating. That's what Israel did when they built this golden calf. And history has continued to repeat itself, and we're about to do it in a big way. I've already read this. Beginning in verse 7, God informs Moshe of what your people are doing. Your people, he says. Before, he was saying, these are my people. I'm calling them out to be my people. Well, you know, it's like he's disowned them. And legally, he has. Because that's what divorce is. The covenant was broken. They were now Moshe's people again. The covenant was broken. And Moshe would demonstrate that when he arrived back to the valley floor. We'll get there in a minute. Because it would be necessary after this occurred for the reestablishment of that covenant, which thankfully, you know, Yehovah did. And we'll find later that Moshe was instructed to fashion another set of tablets and bring them up. But as the Lord is instructing Moshe, he tells Moshe to hurry back down that mountain and put a stop to the calf worship. And by the way, Moshe, while you're gone, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to ponder all the different ways I can destroy these people. And I'm just going to have you start over. Well, Moshe, in a very noble gesture, he pleads for mercy for those Israelites. And God relents and grants it. Now, we think, well, did Moshe just really change his mind? Well, you know, like God was indecisive here? No. No, of course not. Yehovah, as he always is in teaching mode, Torah mode. He's showing Moshe just how serious disobedience is to him. He's showing Moshe that indeed these people are his responsibility. He's demonstrating that it didn't have to be Israel that he called out to be his people. It could have been anybody. It just happened to be them. And so Moshe, in the position of mediator, is the one who bears on his shoulders what's occurred. And so now, Moshe, this is your people. So he's teaching him his responsibility. He's showing them these things. It's kind of like an episode of a sitcom almost. Here are the people of Israel down at the bottom of the foot of the mountain, partying like mad, worshiping and sacrificing and doing all this stuff and proud of themselves for what they've done. Oh, we're going to party because we've done such a great thing, right? The masses come together and say, oh, look at this great thing that we're doing. Look at the size of these churches. All this, yeah, this is a great thing. And at the very same time that they're doing that, Yehovah is up there saying, how am I going to destroy these people? It's sober. It's sober. I also think that Moshe really had yet to grasp the depth of the responsibility that Yehovah had given him. Moshe had always been reluctant, you know, about taking this job. You know, he's described as a humble man. He had a hard time understanding why people would look up to him, I think. But as we saw when God spoke the Ten Commandments by means of a thundering and frightening sound directly to the people, their response was generally, wow, this is really cool. You know, this is awesome. But you know what? Please don't ever do that again. Because that was scary. We don't like that. We'll send Moshe up there. Let him go for us, right? I really think that they thought if they ever heard his voice again, if that ever happened again, they would just die. It was from fear. So when he didn't come back in the time frame that they expected, when they expected it, they panicked. They didn't see what they expected to see, and then they lost faith. And that's what happens. That's what can happen to us. We have expectations of how life should be based on our relationship with God, and he says, no, I have my timing. I'm preparing you for things. I think about Joseph. Joseph had this dream that he was going to be a great leader, that everybody would bow down to him. But then what happens to him? He gets sold into slavery. Then he finally gets to where he's in front of the in the power center, and he gets thrown in prison, and he's there for 2 years. Well, what's going through his mind? God, you said I was going to do great things. You said he's called us and said we're going to be kings and priests. But what's happening? Why are all these bad things happening? It's because I'm preparing you for something. I'm preparing you for something. And these people, they had an expectation, and it wasn't immediately met. So what did they do? They fell back to they lost all their faith in what they had actually seen and heard, and went backwards. And so Moshe, makes his way back down the mountain. He runs into Joshua. This is the same Joshua that would eventually take over for Moshe. Apparently Joshua had gone up the mountain part of the way. Remember, part of the way up the mountain was in some of the people were okay to do that. So he met Joshua halfway down, and Joshua really didn't seem to know what was going on back at the camp. And he said to Moshe, I think there must be war or something going on. Moshe said, no, that's singing. And it ain't good. It isn't good. So they make their way down there, and Moshe finally sees what's going on. It infuriates him. He is mad. He throws the tablets down on the ground. They explode into a zillion pieces. He took the calf and he melted it down, ground it into pieces, threw it in the river, and he made the people drink it. Now I want to say this, because this is something that came up this week. It was actually on a show. We were watching a game show, and it's one of the questions. Yes, Moshe was angry when he threw those down, but I don't believe that he threw them down in uncontrolled anger. The steps that he took, he was angry, but he took deliberate steps, and one of them was intentionally to break those two tablets. Why? Because it was a custom. When you had a covenant, and that covenant was written down on tablets, if the covenant was broken, the stone was broken. And so he was communicating to all of Israel, you done screwed up, guys. The covenant is broken that quick. It's gone already. And so, Moshe has to say, well, Aaron, what were you thinking? And we find that out in verse 21. Moshe said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you've brought so great a sin upon them? Aaron said, do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people. You know how they are. They're set on evil. For they said to me, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moshe, this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. So basically, Aaron's answer was, they asked me to do it. A little distraction going on upstairs. So Aaron's answer was, hey, they wanted me to do it. You see any parallel there to today? See, that's what this Bible is for us to look at these things and parallel them to not only look at our situation personally, but corporately. What is going on today on the pulpits across this globe? It's the exact same thing that many ministers are doing in churches today. Give the people what they want. Tell them what they want to hear. Tickle their ears. Because if you don't, they'll go down the street and put their money in another basket. Give them what they want. And so that is something that everyone that teaches or guides people in the Word of God should be asking themselves. Do I please God or do I please my congregation? Aaron didn't choose well. So then Moshe had to throw down the gauntlet. We read this starting in verse 26. Moshe stood in the entrance of the camp and said, "Whoever is on the Lord's side, come to me." And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves to him. And he said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let every man put his sword on his side and go in and out from entrance to entrance throughout the camp, and let every man kill his brother, every man his companion, and every man his neighbor." And so the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moshe, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. And Moshe said, "Consecrate yourselves today to the Lord, that he may bestow on you a blessing this day, for every man has opposed his son and his brother." Who'd he say that to? He said it to the Levites. He called all those to stand before him, that would stand before him, and in doing so would also stand with God, to come to him. And Moshe is doing what God demonstrated to us since the moment he separated darkness from light. He divides and separates. But not to create chaos like Satan does. Satan's doing that in our nation right now. Dividing. Everything is divisive in our society right now. But when God does it, he's doing it to create unity. I know it kind of flies in the face of a typical modern day doctrine. But here's the thing. Unity at any cost, that sort of thinking or doctrine doesn't square with Holy Scripture. It doesn't. Primarily because it's too simplistic. God divides and separates in order to achieve unity. I mean, my goodness, here in Exodus, he is well into the process of doing what? Dividing Israel from the rest of the world as his people. And here in Exodus 32, now we have Moshe further dividing and separating the people in order to achieve God's kind of unity. Division and separation and election are God's ways to achieve ideal unity. Sadly, the world and the church have fallen into the trap that defines unity as compromise to achieve consensus. No, we'll never achieve consensus to build unity. We are fallen. God's unity has nothing to do with consensus or compromise. Unity is a oneness with his spirit and his ways, being in agreement with the sovereign, period. And it was the Levites, those destined to be priests, and attendants to Jehovah, who rallied around Moshe. Now remember, they weren't priests yet, right? That priesthood was yet to be established. These Levites who came to Moshe did that primarily for tribal reasons, because Moshe was a Levite. He was the leader of all Israel, but also he was the leader of the Levite tribe. And so each one of the Levites took a sword and went about killing 3,000 of the calf worshipers. And the wording makes it appear that they must have killed not only Levites, but get this, or not that they not only killed Israelites, but they killed Levites as well, who had succumbed to idol worship. Because in verse 29, he says, consecrate yourself, because every man has opposed his son and his brother, some even in their own tribe. So don't miss the point that what separated or consecrated these men, what did that? Are you following? Are you with me? I know it's getting warm in here. I don't know why. But stay with me. You got to understand this. What consecrated these people? Everybody was Israelites. Moses said, hey, come to me, anybody who will stand with the Lord. Who came? The Levites. Then who did God make the priests to be? The Levites. He consecrated and set them apart for one reason and one reason only: their decision. They made a decision to follow God. And that is what set them apart. That is what consecrated them. Not their blood. I don't have time. I'm running out of time. So we'll pick this up later when we get to Pentecost. But if you'll recall, there was 3,000 men that were baptized on Pentecost. You want to make those links? I've done it before. Do you remember? For now, let's move on, though. The Levites are an interesting contradiction of character. I want to bring this out because back in Genesis, Jacob was pronouncing his deathbed blessing on his children. And he told Simeon and Levi that violence would follow them. But he also told them something else that's now coming true right here. Genesis 49, verses 5 and 7 says, Simeon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty. This is him giving the blessing to them. Their brothers, instruments of cruelty, are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. Nor in their anger they shall slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. For in their anger they did those things. Verse 7, cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob. Hear this. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. See, recall that it was Levi and Simeon who led the raid on the city of Shechem for the revenge of the king's son raping their Dinah, their sister. So they went in there and they slaughtered all the males, they killed all the cattle, they made slaves of the women and the children that they spared. And as a result of this, Jacob said that Simeon and Levi would find their destinies as constantly dealing in blood and violence. And Jacob pronounced even more here. He said, I will divide them in Jacob. That happened right at the base of, remember, all Jacob, Israel is another name for Jacob. So all of Israel was Jacob. And he said, I will divide Levi out of Jacob. And he did that right here. He did that right at the base. He said, who's gonna stand with me? And Levi was divided out from the rest of the camp, out of the rest of Israel. All right? And then later on, we see the other part of this prophetic thing where he says that they will always have to deal with blood and violence. Right? So it's interesting, isn't it? These are the ones that are about to become priests. They will be dealing with what on a daily basis? The sacrificial system. They will be killing animals, draining blood, dealing with that every single day. And so look at the contrast there. I am really fighting here to keep everybody's attention. Here. No, I don't feel like anybody's hearing
you. You've
me
got it, but this
okay.
is 24/7.
Okay. All right. So you think about that prophetic deal there. So he says, look, you were violent, and that was evil. Now you are destined to have to deal with that violence and that blood. And Then he made them the priests later, and so we have this parallel of them dealing in the blood and the violence in an evil way against God and having to continue to do it, but yet in agreement with God, still dealing with that same prophecy. Okay. Where was I here? So after the mass execution of all these idol worshipers, Moshe made it clear that Israel had sinned against Yehovah, that they had broken the covenant, that he as the mediator now needed to approach God to see if there was a way to atone for this corruption, and more importantly, reestablish the Mosaic covenant. We read this here, starting verse 31. Then Moshe returned to the Lord and said, "Oh, these people have committed a great sin and have made themselves a god of gold. Yet now, if you will forgive me their sin, but if not, I pray, blot me out of your book which you have written." Moshe is trying to make a pretty honorable deal here for his people. And the Lord said to Moshe, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. Now therefore go, lead the people to the place of which I have spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit for punishment, I will visit punishment upon them for their sin." On them. He didn't take his offer. So the Lord plagued the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron made. So in a nutshell, Moshe climbs back up to the mountain. He begs God to blot him out of the book of life forever if that's what it's going to take to save the people. In response, Yehovah lays down the principle that a man is responsible for their own sin, and so declines Moshe's offer for his own life as atonement. There isn't any other alternative than for death for sin, and so thankfully we have that now through Yeshua. Those 3,000 that were put to the sword by the Levites, I believe we're just the tip of the iceberg, because it says here that he plagued the people because of what they did. So I think many, many, many more died as a result of illness. So anyway, that's quite a few things buried, I think, in this story. There's probably more. A lot of lessons contained here. What I saw as I was looking through this is I haven't really seen any that mankind has remembered. We haven't learned the lessons. I forget who said it, but it's back in 1840, I believe. I don't remember the man's name, but everybody's heard this. Anyone who forgets history is destined to repeat it. And I think we're seeing that. And it's a shame, because The lessons here are pretty huge. They're very direct. I don't see how you can misunderstand them, but yet we do. And so I'm saying to you, don't let that be your fate. We need to continually remind each other that Yehovah is sovereign. As creator, it's his sole right to decide how things are done. We are the creation. We are not the creator. And it's all him to get to decide these matters. How his kingdom will operate, how he is to be worshipped, when, where, and how. And we either come into agreement with that, or, like what happened at the base of that mountain, we will suffer the consequences. And I think it's a good time to take stock and say, where do you want to be? Do you want to be on the floor of the valley, in fear, looking backwards to what is comfortable and what is safe, you think, while at the same time, God is revealing to his people, preparing his bride, where do you want to be? You want to be on the summit, or do you want to be on the floor of the valley? We'll end here and we'll pick up next time again with Moshe back up on the mountain, and we'll see what more Yehovah has to say to him at that point. Amen? Amen.